Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Trouble sleeping? You are not alone. There are many reasons for sleep disruption, and the pandemic doesn't help matters. Today, we discuss sleep disorders, why sleep is so important, and how we might get a better night's sleep. With us this morning, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Committee.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And social worker Ann Gay. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
So I guess we should start with what sleep is. Mark, what is it and why is it so important to our well-being?
Yeah. Well, sleep is a basic biological process. It's what's called conserved across animal species. In other words, most animals require it, and they might have different forms or patterns of it. But it simply is a process that complicated biological organisms like us need to have a timeout of less interaction with the environment because it costs so much. There's so much energy involved in maintaining our maintaining being alive, and when you have that much energy consumption, you got a lot of waste products, so to speak, build up. The waste products are in the form of chemicals that are waste products of metabolism, for instance, and then also gastrointestinal waste products. So everything kind of builds up during the course of an active day, including waste products and muscles that need to be washed out, so that the muscle can be stronger and keep up its needed activity. So those are the things that drive sleep and or make it so necessary. It is basically a biological function. It's like eating. You can't survive without it, just like you can't survive without eating very long or fluids or water or something. You can't, life is not compatible with it. And the same thing could be said with sleep. But what it actually is a relatively inhibited sensory activity. In other words, when you're awake, you're interacting with the environment in all sorts of ways, perceiving, behaving, doing the things that life, conscious life consists of. But in sleep, everything is kind of toned down, shut down. You're no longer so aware of what's going on. That doesn't mean that you're completely unconscious, like in a coma. That's a different state. But of course, you can be aroused from sleep. But your interaction with the environment is dampened, if you will, and to different degrees. And we'll get into how, the stages of sleep and how those degrees differ. There's inhibition of all the voluntary muscles. Not the involuntary muscles. In other words, you still breathe, you still have your heart beating, you're still producing urine, your GI tract is pretty active. You're not shut down completely, but the voluntary musculature is quiet.
Like you're recharging.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what it is. It's basically recharging all systems, endocrine systems, hormone systems. Everything kind of gets, life is expensive. It wears down the physical mechanisms and the chemical mechanisms that keep us alive. So you need time to kind of basically do just that, recharge. Without it, you find your functioning during waking time is really compromised.
I think anybody can think about that. If you haven't had sleep or you're sleep deprived and you're like, you just can't think straight, right? And you do these crazy things and you're like, what is going on? I mean, they use it in torture, right? To keep people awake for hours on end because your brain just can't function at full capacity when you're sleep deprived.
Exactly. Your front part of your brain, the frontal lobe, is turned, not necessarily turned off, but it certainly is underactive because it hasn't been recharged. Yes, it's used in torture. Which is torture because it really alters your sense of consciousness, so that you are more easily influenced, certainly, because you're the front part of your brain, the thinking part, the part that weighs the pros and cons of decisions, is not on board. It's not mm-hmm. online. And that has all sorts of consequences, you know, sure. just with daily living, basically.
Yeah. So we have, there's a number of sleep disorders, right? I think insomnia comes to mind, but, you know, there's sleep apnea, narcolepsy. I mean, there's a whole list of sleep disorders, right?
Yeah, there's certain, like any biological process, there can be variation, and we call a disorder, we call a variation a disorder when it really interferes. So there are different patterns of sleep that interfere with good biological functioning. The most common that we're aware of, and you know, everybody really experiences in one way or another at times, is insomnia, deficiency of sleep. And then there's also the opposite. There's hypersomnia, which is too much sleep. There's consequences to that, too.
I want to ask you about hypersomnia, because that's something I always think, too much sleep. How do people do that? I don't know. I mean, you know, is that maybe caused by depression or something like that? That you just don't want to get out of bed, or what exactly is hypersomnia?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Well, one way of thinking about the biological mechanism of sleep is think of it as two switches in the brain. And they each can be on or off. There's one switch that initiates and maintains sleep. So if you put that on, you go to sleep. There's another switch that regulates, and I'm talking about a little bit of a different circuit that regulates being awake. So if that switch, in order to sleep, you have to have the awake switch off and the sleep switch on, okay? But it can get screwed up. If somebody is sleeping too much, presumably their awake switch is sluggish. It doesn't get on enough. I can't tell you the exact mechanism of that, but in a large part, it can have to do with genetics, actually. But their awake switch is sluggish, and so they sleep excessive hours and might be sluggish even during the day. And then that's basically a biological phenomenon. And of course, depression is also a biological phenomenon and can be expressed with insomnia and also hypersomnia. Mood has a lot to do with sleep. Mood variation and especially mood disorders like depression or mania interfere with sleep. They're all kind of wrapped up. So you can have too little, you can have too much. Sides of a coin. Narcolepsy is an interesting disorder. It's relatively rare, but that is where a person has a sleep attack. It's like a seizure almost. They all of a sudden fall asleep. You might be talking to them, they might be in the middle of something, and they just kind of space out. Sometimes they drop their head. And they're not aware, generally not aware of what goes on during the time that they're absent. It's not a seizure, but it's like that. So they obviously can be dangerous driving a car.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be disabling, but it is relatively rare. It is a genetic condition, more or less. Then there's others, sleepwalking people.
Do we find sleepwalking mostly in children, or do adults sleepwalk as well?
Well, adults can do it too.
They do, yeah.
A lot of times these sleep disorders kind of go together. In other words, you might have a touch of narcolepsy, and you also sleepwalk, and then you also have restless legs during sleep, or limb movements. It's called periodic limb movements, people that kick in the middle of the night, for instance. Could be related to dreams and sometimes not. It just is a muscular, neuromuscular phenomenon. Restless legs is important. Sleep disorder, because it usually happens during sleep. It can happen during the day too, but that could be quite bothersome. And then there's a disorder called rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, which is, think of the PTSD people that act out their trauma in the middle of the night. That would describe them. We'll talk about REM phase, but during that particular part of the sleep cycle, these people, their inhibition on their voluntary muscles is lifted, so they can perform all sorts of complicated behaviors. They can even drive. A lot of times they might get up and eat in the middle of the night, and prepare a meal and not remember.
And not remember it, right? And not remember it in the morning, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Sleep is a fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah, it sure is. Anne or Jonathan, you want to add anything to what Mark's saying?
Go ahead, Anne.
Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
You go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I think it will be important to talk about Mark just referenced this, the different phases of sleep, because when the disruption comes, either in the REM or non-REM sleep, then the consequences of that disruption, such as you just said, Mark, with the REM sleep is the dreaming part. And so I think for folks that have had PTSD, that the reality of the dream is not seen as a dream, it's seen as real. And the reaction to that is, can be in behaviors that people don't even remember, as you said. A lot of people, of course, can get to sleep right away, but then 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, they're wide awake. And I've noticed this is always something, because of my work with folks in grief, this is always something that we discuss, because there is, usually they can fall asleep, everything's fine, but then they wake up in this high alert state, and then the anxiety, and then the remembering that their loved one has died, and then the tension. And again, we can go into that more. And then the fear of not being able to get back to sleep. So it has, consequences. Certainly the people that can't get to sleep and have that habitual fear of, oh my God, I'm going to get into bed, I'm not going to be able to sleep, oh my God, it's going to ruin my day tomorrow, it's going to ruin, everything, I'll be slugging around. So the fear and anxiety becomes part of this pattern. And so it's where in the sleep cycle the disruption happens, I think, is important to delineate.
Sure.
Yeah, Jonathan, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to say a couple of things. One is that problems falling asleep or staying asleep seem to have become a much more common problem over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, certainly in my practice, that is a much more frequent and more tenacious, more difficult to treat a problem that people appear with. As you were alluding to earlier, often in depression, people either sleep too little or too much. But even without the presence of clinical depression, sleep problems have become a huge problem. And that's not even including this pandemic, which has given rise to an entire new generation of sleep problems. It's been noted all across the planet during the pandemic that sleep is much more frequently disrupted. People are reporting much more vivid dreams than ever before, and there's a whole new generation of sleep issues and descriptions of sleep problems since the pandemic began. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that. Maybe some, yeah, there are some people who would like to call in and ask or describe some of their, what they've noticed in their own sleep changes.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about sleep disorders, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about sleep disorders with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So before the break, Jonathan, you were mentioning about dreams and the vivid dreams a lot of people are having in this pandemic. And it's just sometimes, even, you know, with, before the pandemic, some of the dreams you wake up and they're so real. It, you know, you wake up and you go, wow, and it can keep you awake, because, you know, especially if it's a nightmare or it gets you thinking about something. But and then if it's something really nice, you're like, wait, no, I want to go back to that dream. But let's talk about what's happening when we're dreaming. And especially now, I'm thinking a lot of the dreams that we're having in this pandemic are probably stress induced. I know I have dreams constantly of being in some large gathering and then all of a sudden going, oh, wait, none of us have on masks, right? It's a kind of that anxiety dream, and I'm sure other people are having this. Is that what's happening here with the pandemic? Is it's kind of more stress and anxiety induced?
Yeah, I think to fully understand this, it makes sense to get into the phases of sleep, so we know what we're know a little bit about what we're talking about and why dreams happen more or less in actually mostly in one phase. Sleep is the time that people spent in sleep is divided into two categories. One is called non-REM, and the other one is REM. REM is rapid eye movement, because that's how it was first identified. Rapid eye movement means your eyes are closed, but your eyeballs are going back and forth, almost like you're watching a tennis match kind of thing. So those are two basic phases. Most of our sleep time is spent in non-REM. That's how you start out in non-REM. You get drowsy, and then you go through a certain stages of non-REM sleep, the stages being defined by brainwave patterns. And the thing to remember is the third stage is the really restorative phase of sleep, slow wave sleep it's called. That is a part of sleep that restores your energy and restores your sense of motivation, all sorts of kind of mood kind of things. So if you're deprived of that particular phase of sleep, and there have been experiments to do this, people are awakened when the brainwave says that they're in that phase, they're pretty miserable the next day because they haven't had any restorative sleep. And then there's REM sleep, and there's a kind of a pattern of these stages that everybody goes through, and the patterns are non-REM sleep, which consists of several phases, ending with a slow wave, and then REM sleep, which is shorter, and is a stage of very active brain activity. The electrical discharges are really active, so it's almost like you think you'd be awake, and in some ways you are. You're still asleep, but that's the phase where dreaming happens. Now, these phases, these cycles, rather, there's about, to have a good night's sleep, you have to have four or five of these cycles, going from non-REM to REM, non-REM to REM, four or five times during the night, and each phase, each cycle, rather, lasts about 90 minutes. So you tend to remember dreams if you get conscious shortly after or during the dream, whereas you dream throughout the night and you just don't remember them, because when you wake, you have them in a kind of partial memory store, so you can remember them, and that's why nightmares can be so disturbing because you wake up in the middle of it and you're aware of the danger or the experience of it. And that's why nightmares usually will happen early in the morning. Because that's your last stage of REM sleep, and you wake up and you experience it. It's not a rule, but you will remember dreams early in the morning that you may have been part of dreams that occurred at midnight or 1 a.m. or something like that. But you'll remember the later ones. So you have to have that kind of basic knowledge and as a groundwork to start talking about dreams and what happens during it. You know, we used to rely on content of dreams a lot in psychiatry. Freud said it was the royal road to the unconscious. That's the way he formulated dreams, and had it, so dreams had a lot of meaning, meaning in terms of repressed wishes, for instance, and wish fulfillment kind of things. So nowadays we really don't, you know, attribute such importance to the meaning, because it the content of a dream, it has so many different determinants,
variable. It's like, you know, you see like these dream interpretations and I think, what does that mean? You know, they say, what, you're dreaming of a house, you're dreaming of yourself. Well, maybe no, right? Because there's so many, in each individual, there's so many things that could be going on and influencing that dream, right?
Exactly.
So it would be really tough to you know, really interpret what the meaning of every dream is, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Dreaming is, the dreaming state is of decreased awareness and certainly no conscious control over the way the dream goes. Although interesting, it just reminds me, there is a mode of psychotherapy that tries to get control over the content of dreams to have a better outcome, for instance, in PTSD experiences. And that's been proven to be effective for some people. But at any rate, it's a normal phenomenon of the brain in this REM pattern, REM stage of sleep that is closer to being awake than any other stage in sleep. But you're not awake. You're semi-awake. And that's when the dream can happen that you remember.
So we're seeing evidence from China and Europe suggesting that prolonged confinement is altering sleep in adults as well as children. Doctors in the United States seeing this too, and this is all pandemic related, right? We're all kind of, you know, somewhat isolated, confined, somewhat to our homes.
We're all under threat.
Yeah.
We're no longer, the world isn't safe like it, you know, we could think it was. We could go day in and day out believing, but we're all under threat. We're constrained in our activities, our interactions, we're simply under threat. It's scary. You know, our generation certainly hasn't faced it. Our parents may have in 1918, but we haven't experienced anything like
right.
this.
So.
It's quite a challenge.
Jonathan, what do you, as far as the pandemic, and what are you seeing in your patients as far as sleep disruptions and dreams? You mentioned that it's been on the rise even before the pandemic, but are you seeing this kind of?
What I've had a lot of patients describe, and not just patients, because we're really all patients in the great
right.
level of life, as I like to say. But you know, many of my friends, I myself, have had much more vivid dreams than ever before. And I wonder exactly why that is, that so many people are having this. Now, we know that diet and nutrition can affect sleep, you know, not only the length of time it takes to get to sleep, but also whether or not your sleep is interrupted during the night. I don't know about the literature or the research on how diet might also affect dreams, but I suspect that my my love of dark chocolate, which has increased, the consumption of which has increased during the pandemic, might also be accelerating or increasing the vividness of dreams. I don't know if Mark or Ann know anything about the specifics of foods and dreams, but it's interesting. And I also think that what I have seen on so many levels, both among what we would call normal people, or as well as people who have diagnoses like depression or anxiety disorders, is that I think the pandemic has taken almost everybody down a notch. I think people who are ordinarily calm and kind and generous are maybe a little less patient than usual, a little bit quicker to fatigue. I think people who already are struggling with difficulty are contacting me and asking me for an increase in their medications. I think everybody, whether in subtle or not so subtle ways, is gradually being worn down by all the restrictions and the difficulty of being with the people that you're accustomed to being with and doing the things that you love to do, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that is manifest in changes in sleep as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I think with families educating their children at home, for elderly that don't have the options to socialize, our patterning has completely shifted. Children are going to, well, they can sleep in the morning, so it's very hard. There's no pattern that when children go to school, they're up at, 7 and they eat breakfast at 7:30 and they get on the bus and they go and mom does her thing and dad does his thing and then we come back and there is some patterning. With this, there's boredom and there's a break on just the regular daily routines. So that's why we've stressed so much in this little series we've had about creating routines. Right. The depression that comes with this threat makes it, you get into the psychology of why bother? I'll just stay in my pajamas all day. Mm-hmm. But that is going to affect sleep. That's going to affect eating patterns. It's going to affect social interaction patterns. So I think one of the things that it's all connected. And if we can look at taking some control over, yes, I'm having trouble getting to sleep or I'm waking up in the middle of the night, what can I do with that? And not eat, at weird hours, but really maybe start with the sleep, because you can repattern your sleep through, behavioral activities, and perhaps that will help regulate your digestion. It's all connected, and it's about repatterning.
And what I'm hearing you say is routine is important, right? That routine.
It's so important.
Yeah.
And also pointing out, routine, we have a biological routine that governs sleep and wake cycles. It's called the circadian rhythm. And it is a biological clock that operates on a 24-hour, roughly 24-hour cycle. It involves changes in temperature, hormone levels, blood pressures, all sorts of things, and especially the onset of sleep and its maintenance and its termination, in other words, waking. So if you have a disordered pattern in your daily life, which we do have, because it used to be we would get up with alarm clocks, and a lot of times we don't need that now, because we don't have to be at 7 a.m. for getting up and doing all the things necessary to get onto the bus, for instance. So we drift a little bit, and that affects our circadian rhythm, such that the term for it is phase shifting, which means your onset of sleep, for instance, will be delayed to a later time than usual, because we don't have so much of a motivation to get to sleep early, because we got to get going at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
So we shift our phases, and that actually has biological consequences, and also is influenced by psychological patterns or behavior patterns that you're mentioning, Anne, that are so important. The routine that we can voluntarily create, but there is a involuntary cycle, mm-hmm. circadian rhythm cycle that we can influence, but it's still there. And I think, Jonathan, you were talking about the dreaming before. I think that might be playing a part in more dreaming during this pandemic because our wake time is variable and is not set by our daily schedule a lot. Everybody is different in terms of their situation, but I just wonder if that's playing a part in the phenomenon that you mentioned about more vivid dreams during this pandemic thing.
Let's talk to Pat, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I am one of those who usually goes to sleep easily but wakes up after 3 to 4 hours and have trouble getting back to sleep. I also almost never remember dreaming, but during the following day, I am alert and never tired, even after only a few hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. Is this lack of sleep harmful to me?
You know, Pat's bringing up a good question, is how much sleep do you need? And, you know, everybody says 8 hours. There are some people who function really well with just 4 hours sleep. So it's really individual, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Matthew Walker, who Terry Gross has had on her show, he's a professor at Stanford and spends his entire life, if I may say, eating, breathing, and sleeping sleep, claims that, you know, everybody, pretty much everybody needs 7 to 8 hours of sleep in order to accomplish these multiple cycles of REM and non-REM and so on. But my life experience tells me that there are people who function very well and most satisfactorily on much less sleep, and there are people who need more sleep, it seems. One of my most beloved mentors and teachers when I was doing my psychiatry residency in Boston, Dr. Messner, he slept 3 hours a night for decades. And he would he lived in Amesbury, and he would get up. I think he slept between midnight and 3, and he would get up and drive to his office, which was next to the hospital, at about 3:30 in the morning, avoiding rush hour and a whole lot of other things. And you know, I mean, Dr. Messner didn't always look like the picture of health, but he functioned very well, and he was brilliant for many, many years and taught many of us a lot about psychiatry. And I always think of him, you know, when this subject comes up. I have other patients who sleep, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours a night for, they're, you know, I guess fortunate to be able to do that for decades and show no signs of being any the worse off for it. So there are exceptions, like for anything else, there are exceptions. Not everybody fits into the middle of the bell curve.
Yeah. So sure. Pat, if you're feeling okay, then you know, then it should be fine. I would think. Yeah,
I've been existing on 2 to 5 hours of sleep, I guess. For decades.
We're very lucky.
Never feel tired during the day. In fact,
we're jealous, Pat. Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about sleep disorders with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jennifer in East Ham writes, is it true that you can bank sleep? If you get a lousy night's sleep one night, can you make it up over the weekend? Also, I hear a lot about having a halting caffeine intake. What do you recommend? Stop the intake by noon, so a caffeinated coffee limit by 12 noon to get a better night's sleep.
Well, again, I'll refer to Dr. Walker, who certainly is an expert on this. He claims that you cannot bank sleep. You can't catch up on the weekend for sleep that you missed out during the week. We know, of course, teenagers routinely do this. Will sleep late on the weekends after going to bed at 1 or 2 in the morning and getting up at 6 in the pre-pandemic world, at least, to go to school. But Dr. Walker says that there are long-term consequences for sleep deprivation. I know that came as sad news to Terry Gross, who told Dr. Walker that she counted on her weekends to make up for her 5 to 6 hours of sleep on her, on a more daily basis. But he said, no, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. What about the caffeine intake? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the general recommendation is not to have any caffeine or stimulant within 5 hours of bedtime, 5 hours before. That's a general guideline.
Again, that varies.
Some people shouldn't have it afternoon. It depends on your metabolism and just how you react to caffeine, which is variable.
Yeah. I have another email here. Good morning. I'm wondering about the lasting impact of alcohol use on sleep. I've read about the regularity of interrupted sleep after consuming alcohol and identified strongly with stories of regular drinkers waking in the middle of the night. I've been sober for 4 months, largely motivated by improving my sleep, but I still wake up at 2:30 or 3 a.m. just as I always did while drinking. Is this continued sleep disruption typical for those who've recently quit drinking? Can the brain relearn a better sleep pattern and get past this habit of waking up at the same hour nightly?
Yeah, I would answer yes, that it is a learned response that was biologically instituted by the alcohol. In other words, alcohol is a sedative. It quiets the brain. So you drink a lot in the evening, go to sleep very easily. However, the alcohol is metabolized while you're sleeping. So it drops, the level drops, and then the nervous system rebounds so that you're more alert. So that's what wakes the alcoholic in the middle of the night. And obviously, like addiction, you can train your brain. The biology will become a pattern. The longer she stays sober, more normal, if you will, it's more likely that she won't have that pattern of waking in the middle of the night so much.
Right.
You can do things at that time when you wake up at that time and not panic and not get overwhelmed and not get anxious, but do some, you know, we'll talk about the interventions, but do some deep breathing exercises. If it persists, we'll get up and do something else and then come back to bed. But it's not determined that has to happen from now on. It's, again, the body takes a long time to be retrained and get habituated to different patterns.
Yeah, you're talking about the concept of sleep hygiene, which is an interesting word. Behavioral health psychiatry actually used to come under the heading of mental hygiene. Sleep hygiene is a very important concept to learn about, because there's all sorts of things you can do in the middle of the night and sorts of things you should avoid, like turning on the TV. The TV is bright light, blue light, which is activating, just like sunlight, and it changes your biological clock, your circadian rhythm. Also, you don't want to get up and do push-ups or exercise generally. That will kind of make you more alert. Instead, you want to do something, I think you're suggesting, Ann, something that's quiet, serene, and you don't want to stay in the bed longer than 20 minutes when you're not sleeping. You want to if you're into that and that happens, try to force yourself to get up, go to a different room, maybe sit down, listen to the soft music, keep the lights off. Or if you're going to turn the light on, read something quietly.
Mark, you know, I want to. You mentioned the blue screen, and now we're talking reading. That the light on the screen. So you don't want to wake up and open up your iPad and read, right? You want to read like a book or a magazine, something that's not got light to it, right?
Exactly, or it's just reflected light. Not the bright electronic devices. Emit or the way they use light that's weighted toward the bright spectrum. So that's what sunlight is. So no, you don't want to expose yourself to that. There are glasses that people can buy that diminish blue light, and that's not a bad thing, a little gadget to get. You can read with those, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or if you are going to look at your email or something, not recommended, but do it with blue glasses, a blue light blocking glasses.
Yeah, don't read the email. That's just going to wake you right up because you'll want to. Let's talk to Dennis, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Dennis. Dennis. Okay, we've lost Dennis. All right, we have another email. Let's see. This one is, I think it would help to ground the discussion in neurology. Neural activity is constant. The brain is, if not processing during waking hours, also facilitating connections between existing neurons. We do learn while sleeping and or activities unrelated to the present.
Oh, is that right?
I think one of the important concepts that's quite current and new is that there is actual the physical, physiological cleaning of dead cells and waste products from the brain during the night. One of the functions of the cerebral spinal fluid and other fluids, I suppose, is during the night actually cleaning the detritus from the day from the brain, and when you don't get enough sleep, there is some cumulative effect over time of, you know, maybe being at a higher risk. Well, there is evidence of perhaps being higher risk of dementia if you're chronically deprived of sleep. And I don't mean deprived like not being given any sleep, but even if you're just not getting enough sleep chronically. So there's so much to take into account. I know, again, referring to Dr. Walker, that he's not a big fan of sleep medications. And people who have trouble sleeping, and I don't know if this is an American phenomenon or a global phenomenon, but people often look for a pill to help fix the sleep problem. And there are now many, many different kinds of medicines that have different mechanisms of action of how they assist with sleep. Melatonin, which is, again, actually functions very, very differently in the brain. This Ambien, you know, people, I'm sure people listening can rattle off the names of many, many medications. There's also a whole new generation of medicines, one of which I just heard about last week for the first time, called Dayvigo, and there's Hetlioz, which are probably both medicines that most people have never heard of, but are just recently on the market. These are all ways of tackling the problem of insomnia from different angles. But the bottom line is that if you, at least it's my view, that if you are taking something on a nightly basis for a long period of time to help assist you to either get asleep or stay asleep, your brain does forget how to do it on its own. And it can be quite challenging to get back, just as was hinted by the email that you received from the person who has now not been drinking for several months.
Right.
It can be very tricky.
Yeah, got a couple of emails here. Fritz says
exercise, also physical activity, is so important in being able to have a good sleep. And the large majority of Americans, at least, aren't getting adequate exercise. And that's a contributor to poor sleep.
Yeah. Right? Fritz writes, I get 6 to 7 hours of good sleep each night, consistently to sleep at 10 and awake at 5. But when I try to read during the day, I can't stay awake. That's kind of like the where you're falling asleep on the couch, right? And you go to bed and you're wide awake. But yeah, so Fritz, thanks for sharing that. And then another email we have, Molly says, get out of bed, sit in a chair, and read something super boring, such as the Old Testament or, in my case, Les Miserables. Thanks, Molly, for that.
Good idea.
And Denya says, when I am in a time of erratic sleep, an hour before bed, I take tryptophan and drink a small but concentrated cup of sleep tea, chamomile, or a blend. If I wake up in the night, I take Rescue Remedy, which is homeopathic and made from flowers. It usually takes only 15 minutes to fall back asleep after Rescue Remedy. So I guess in the last few minutes we have, let's talk about some thoughts on how do we get a good night's sleep? What are some things that we can do? Jonathan mentioned exercise. That's always a good one. We do that with the kids, right? Exercise them so that they'll crash and go to sleep and sleep well. So what are some of the things we can do get a better night's sleep?
It definitely has an impact on sleep. Having a lot of carbohydrates in the evening will likely put you to sleep, but like alcohol, which is a carbohydrate actually, like alcohol, it gets metabolized and there's a rebound, so your sleep can be interrupted. So you want to stay away from junk food, basically. Everything that comes under the heading of junk food, avoid. It's been shown that people who sleep poorly are more likely to crave junk food. Reminds me of our president, perhaps. Diet is an important thing. Have a healthy diet is the bottom line prescription without getting into details. Everybody knows a Mediterranean diet, for instance, falls under this category of a healthy diet.
You're saying healthy diet. We had Jonathan exercise and talked about routine, all things that we should be thinking about. Let's try to squeeze Dennis. Dennis is called back. Let's talk to Dennis. Calling from Dennis. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I just wondered what you knew about intermittent sleep, because due to an overactive bladder, I only sleep for an hour to an hour and a half at a time, and I'm up 8 or 10 times a night, and this has been going on for decades. I'm not particularly dragged out during the day, but I rarely wake up refreshed and ready to go.
Yeah, good question. We've got a couple minutes.
That would be.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. A couple minutes left there to answer the question. Anybody have thoughts on that, intermittent sleep?
One thing, his story, I would recommend him to talk to his PCP because there's some medication that can help with the urine issue, frequency issue. I think that the bottom line is how you do during the day. And he's saying that he's not doing so bad. So don't worry about it.
But that's a good suggestion. Talk to your doctor about helping with that bladder condition. Just real quickly, there's lots of apps, right? Sleep tracking devices and apps, and maybe not so accurate. But Anne, you checked out an app called Insomnia Coach. It's free, and you said you thought it was great.
It was. It's very good. It was designed by Department of Veterans Affairs, so it was, I believe, really a app that was going to help soldiers or a military who perhaps have PTSD. It's very simple. It's free, and I went through it, and it has every category that we've talked about as far as interventions about, you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night to get up. The number one sleep directive is beds are for sleep and sex.
Right.
And don't use them for entertainment centers. Don't use them for dining halls. Don't use them for anything else but sleep and sex. The other thing is don't try and go to sleep when you're just tired. Go to sleep when you're sleepy. Mm-hmm. And there is a difference. If you get in the habit of delineating that, you won't have those like, I'm tired, but I'm wide awake. This app has interventions for everything. It has a sleep calendar that you can put in to track your sleep, and it has encouragement throughout the whole app.
A lot of people have been telling me has been helpful to them is called Calm, C-A-L-M. Mm-hmm. I think there's both a free and a paid version of it, but that's available on your smartphone.
Okay. That's all we have the time for today. Social worker Anne Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Happy holiday. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Happy holidays.